This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Der Handel an den Weltfinanzmärkten ist nicht einfach. Doch nur weil der Handel etwas schwierig sein kann, heißt das nicht, dass Ihr Broker es auch sein muss. Bei Kapital.com möchten wir Ihnen den Handel so einfach wie möglich machen. Ganz gleich, ob Sie ein Konto eröffnen oder eine Position auf unserer übersichtlichen, benutzerfreundlichen Plattform eröffnen möchten. Schauen Sie noch heute bei Kapital.com vorbei und finden Sie heraus, wie wir Ihnen helfen können, intelligenter zu handeln. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld. Geht es Ihnen nicht auch auf die Nerven, wenn ein Unternehmen mit all seinen Auszeichnungen prahlt? Uns auch. Fühlt sich so aufgesetzt an, oder? Mit uns von Kapital.com können Sie sich also wieder Ihrem Podcast widmen. Übrigens haben wir bei den 2024 Online Money Awards die Auszeichnung Best Overall Trading Plattform erhalten. Oh, ups. Kapital.com. Viel besser in Sachen Trading als in Sachen Werbung. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. It has been the worst outbreak of violence and bloodletting in Syria since the fall of the Assad regime at the end of last year. The British-based monitoring group, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, says more than 1,000 people have been killed in the space of just a few days. Many, perhaps most of them, civilians living in areas traditionally loyal to the ousted president. That's along Syria's Mediterranean coast. The fighting began when the country's new Islamist-led security forces were ambushed by fighters loyal to Bashar al-Assad. Further clashes ensued, together with revenge killings against the Alawite community, the minority sect to which the Assad family belonged. While Syria's new interim leader, Ahmad al-Sharaa, has called for an end to the violence and called for national unity.
What's currently happening in the country comes within the expected challenges. We have to preserve national unity and domestic peace, and, God willing, we can live together in this country.
Well, a short time ago, I spoke to Hiba. She is Alawite and spoke to me from Banias, one of the towns worst affected by the violence. I asked her what she'd seen.
They came and attacked our neighbourhood. Our neighbours were killed, including children. They came and they took everything, gold, everything. And for the last 3 days, we've had no water, no power. We had to use batteries, whatever we could, to stay connected. They came and they smashed up our car and then they stole it. They stole all of the cars in the neighbourhood. They even went to the supermarket and they took everything from the shelves. They robbed the supermarket.
And who is they? Who were they, the fighters that came to your town?
Shishan.
It was Chechens. Chechens and the army of Ahmad Sharaa, who were asked to go to the coast. They killed our neighbour in front of his child.
You must have been very, very scared.
We were really afraid. We were waiting for our turn. We didn't know when it would come. We saw death. We saw people dying in front of us. And now all of our friends, our neighbours, they're gone.
Do you think these attacks, these massacres, were they revenge killings for all the crimes of the Assad regime? Do you think that's what was happening?
What the Assad regime did was a response to things that were done by the Nusra Front, for example. We've never seen something like this in Syria before. Killing people one by one. Executions.
And what is happening today? Are things quieter today?
Today it is calmer. There has been some gunfire, but they've come and they've taken away the bodies because they heard that journalists and correspondents were coming. They killed innocent people in cold blood who had nothing to do with any of this.
Hiba, speaking to me from Banias on Syria's western coast. Well, let's go live now to the Syrian capital, Damascus, and talk to the BBC's Lina Sinjab, who joins us on the line. And Lina, let's just deal with the latest first of all, because there have been reports of further clashes in that part of Syria again today. Is that right?
Well, there are reports suggesting that remnants of the Assad regime are still clashing with the security forces, and this time in the in the oil refinery around Banias area. So that's still going on at the moment. However, we've heard several reports and accounts that the official security forces and reinforcements sent to various areas where the mass killings took place, especially like in Banias and in Jebli, to restore calm and order and push out all the factions who went in and committed these kind of, mass killing out of these villages.
And yet, as we heard from Hiba in Banias, she suggested that the security forces, the government security forces themselves, were also involved in what happened. Has the government commented on that or condemned that?
Well, there has been, acknowledgement by the government and even by the interim president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, that there has been violations taking place and that those who have committed these violations will be brought to justice. He also called today for national unity so that, the country can overcome this crisis and bring everyone who's involved to justice. It's really hard to confirm who's actually conducted these kind of mass killing, but I've spoken to various voices in Banias, and they all confirmed to me that factions, who entered the city that are combined of Syrians, but also foreign fighters. Some described them as Chechenian or Uzbek who conducted the killing. They also told me that some of ordinary, civilians joined the fight with them, but they were, they were revenge killing, they were looting, they took people's cars, money, gold, and also shot whole families dead. But when the official security forces arrived, things got back to safety and they provide safe corridors for them to leave their homes until, the situation is restored. I spoke to one Alawite as well who is told me that, the bodies will be retrieved today for burial with the support of the official security. So at the moment, it seems that there are a split between those who, the factions who really conducted the mass killing, who are to be, the government should be responsible for them because they are known to be affiliated with the official government.
This is what everyone feared might happen in Syria post-Assad, isn't it?
Well, this is exactly something that, especially the minority were afraid of. And to remind the audience that what happened on Thursday, which led to all these killing, is that the official security were ambushed by remnants of the Assad regime, who actually, shot and killed dozens of them before reinforcement arrived. And then all the violations, were committed. These remnants are still operating. They're still hiding in many mountains, and it is expected that they will create such chaos and call for people to be armed so that to call for separation. They're running away from being prosecuted because of the crimes they've committed during the Assad regime. However, now many people see that the new authorities, part of the new authorities, are conducting similar crimes with this mass killing that happened against the Alawite community. And that's why just right now we've come back from a protest in central Damascus by civilians calling for justice, calling for accountability, and calling for this new government to prosecute those who killed innocent civilians among the Alawite community so that the country can move forward into peace and reconciliation.
Lina, thank you very much indeed for that update. That was our Syria correspondent, Lina Sinjab, joining us live there from the capital, Damascus. The World Health Organization has estimated that one in every 100 people in Gaza has a life-changing injury because of the conflict with Israel. It's difficult for many to leave the territory to get medical treatment. However, a team of Jordanian medics has been able to enter Gaza and fit those who've lost limbs with cutting-edge prosthetics which clip on quickly and easily. Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell has been hearing from innovators, medics and those who have been helped.
In a few months, Lieutenant Abdullah Hameda and his team have seen some 300 patients, fitting each of them with a life-changing prosthetic limb. He's working out of a van at the field hospital that's been specially kitted out. And this fast manufacturing really is something groundbreaking, a world first. Lieutenant Hameda tells me the new technology is having a huge impact on every person he fits.
You can't do anything without giving him his life back.
Restoring Hope is being funded by a national Jordanian charity and is the brainchild of the Jordanian King Abdullah II. And when the war in Gaza was still raging, Ahmed Kaloub, a father in his 20s, came into a tent in Restoring Hope's mobile clinic in Gaza for a checkup with clinician Lieutenant Hameda. He tells me that the prosthetic which he had fitted a few weeks ago has changed his life.
I was struggling to go up and down. Thank God, once I got the prosthetic, I started slowly returning to my normal life. I can now dress myself, go wherever I want. Nothing can stop me now.
The key to it all is a cone made of a special plastic which can be remoulded at high temperatures.
This looks a bit like an industrial hairdryer.
And that's exactly what this is. This is a heat gun which allows us to heat up plastics and manipulate plastics in conventional prosthetics. But we've taken it and created a way of allowing it to heat up our cone.
American prosthetist Alex de Hinton leaves the plastic cone in a makeshift cylindrical oven and goes back to his patient. He is a local man called Hossam. Within about 15 minutes, Alex has fitted pads on Hossam's leg stump, and now the cone is ready.
So now our plastic is the perfect temperature to be able to mold it directly on his limb. It cuts beautifully. When this material is warm, it cuts almost like butter.
He says this technique is much more efficient than what he would have done in the past. There's no plaster casting, no hazardous chemicals.
I almost feel like I dreamed of this material and thought of this material before I was aware of it. It really opens up the opportunities.
And you're getting lifetime feedback.
Yeah, so we can ask if it's feeling, how's it feeling? Is it comfortable? Is it too hot? The thumbs up is a universal symbol.
Alex works for Amparo, the company that developed the new prosthetics, and he's helped train the Jordanian medics now using them in Gaza. The whole setup is very mobile, and there's another useful, special feature of this plastic. It can be remoulded up to 5 times.
So as someone starts to shrink down, starts to get more active again, their leg starts to change. If it changes to a degree where they need a whole new socket, they can come in, and within about half an hour, this socket can be heated and remolded onto their leg.
Fast forward another 45 minutes with Hossam, and...
So this is the moment of truth?
Yeah, this is. Pull it off. There we go. Wow.
Can I feel the material? It's hard now. It's amazing. Once it's finished.
We've effectively recreated the shape of his limb in a heart socket.
And with some on-the-spot adjustments and a foot part attached to a plate built into the socket, before you know it, Hossam is putting on his left trainer and he's walking, taking great strides.
Ah, what is that?
It's good.
Yolan Nell reporting for our colleagues at People Fixing the World, which means you can hear the full programme wherever you get your BBC podcasts. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. To the United States now, and reports that the Department of Homeland Security is performing polygraph tests, commonly known as lie detector tests. They're doing these on staff to try to find out who's been leaking information about immigration operations. The DHS Secretary, Kristi Noem, has blamed lower than expected arrest figures from immigration raids on leaks of details to migrant aid organisations and also to the media. Well, George Mashke is a former US Army intelligence officer and interrogator who co-founded the public interest website antipolygraph.org back in 2000. As the website name suggests, he thinks lie detector tests are a bad thing. So presumably he disapproves of this move.
Yes, I think it's a misguided policy decision because it's likely to result in innocent people being falsely accused. At the same time, anyone who is leaking sensitive information could easily beat the polygraph using simple countermeasures that anyone could learn. So it's not surprising then that in the history of the United States, there's no documented case where the polygraph has ever solved a leak investigation.
So they have been used before to try and find leakers, have they?
Yes, they have, including in the White House during the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And it was an utter failure.
Can employees, federal employees, can they refuse to take the test?
Technically, yes. But if they do, they will suffer adverse employment consequences up to and including termination.
Given that they are still used, presumably they must have some function. They must work to some extent.
Well, they are not scientifically accurate at all. But they do have some usefulness in interrogations where the person who's being questioned doesn't understand that they don't actually work. So if you can convince someone that you can read their mind with a polygraph, they may be more likely to confess if they are in fact guilty. So that's really the key reason that government agencies in the United States continue to cling to the polygraph despite its scientific shortcomings.
But if you're an innocent person and you're perhaps nervous about the scenario, I mean, that might show up as a positive result, might it? That nervousness, even though actually the person hasn't done anything wrong.
That is absolutely right. The polygraph is not able to distinguish between someone who's nervous because they're guilty or someone who's just nervous because they have fallen under suspicion. So it's quite common for truthful people to fail the polygraph, and especially in situations where you're looking for something that's rare and uncommon, you're going to end up with more innocent test takers failing than actually guilty persons.
You failed a polygraph test when you were applying for a job at the FBI. What happened then?
That's correct. I was one of the first people polygraphed by the FBI when they started this policy in 1995. I was a reserve intelligence officer at the time with a top secret clearance, but I was basically accused of being a spy based on polygraph chart readings and disqualified from FBI employment for life as a result. And eventually it led to the end of my career in the U.S. Army as well. So failing a polygraph, if you're telling the truth, can have devastating career consequences, which is something I'm concerned about with the current polygraph dragnet going on in the Department of Homeland Security.
Why is the U.S. so keen on polygraph tests, do you think? I mean, it's not something you ever hear of being used in other places.
The polygraph was invented in the United States at the Berkeley, California Police Department in 1921, and it was quickly adopted by police departments across the United States without proper scientific evaluation. A lot of uncritical journalism helped to promote belief in the polygraph. Since then, some scientific critiques have been done, but they've been largely ignored because the polygraph has such a strong foothold in the bureaucracy in the United States.
George Mashke there. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up in the second half of the program. Welcome back to NewsHour. EU leaders this week put on a show of solidarity with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. At a summit in Brussels, he was promised enduring support by all but one of the bloc's leaders. The meeting was designed as a response to his hostile treatment by the US administration and the subsequent decision to suspend military aid and intelligence support to Kyiv. My colleague Julian Warwick has been talking to Andrius Kubilius, the EU's first Commissioner for Defence, who's been in the job only since December.
Things are changing in a quick and dramatic way, I would say. At the beginning of my mandate, I was saying that we have two challenges with a different time frames. One is Russia and its war in Ukraine and possibility of Russian aggression against the EU or NATO member states. Our intelligence services are predicting that it can happen before 2030. And second, I was always saying that Americans will shift more and more towards mitigation of Chinese power, but it will take, my prediction was, next 10 years. So it started to happen much more quickly. We need to watch, you know, and to see, to make final, you know, conclusions about what is an American strategy. But we have seen, I would call, historical change, the first time when European Union is coming out with very big package financially invested into defense, and that's really a big change.
Let's talk about that, because there's been this statement agreed by all 27 EU leaders endorsing your new defense funding initiatives, which you've put forward. How much difference will that make? How quickly can it make a difference?
Calculation of 800 billion is done looking into 4 years period, how much member states can increase their own defense spending for joint procurement of defense equipment, for development of so-called strategic enablers. So there is a whole list. And also there is a very clear message that money should be used also to support Ukraine.
And how soon could that make a difference on the ground in Ukraine?
I cannot, you know, say in a very simple way when it will make difference, but I can tell one thing, that also those money can be spent together with Ukraine procuring weapons by member states together with Ukraine from Ukrainian defense industry. And Ukrainian defense industry is very dynamic, very mobile. You know, they are producing a lot of drones. Their industry defense capacities are increasing so rapidly that during the last few years, it increased by almost by 30 times. Last year, they ended with production capacity of 35 billion euros. And they have, for time being, contracts only for something like 17 or 18 billion. So we can really spend our money in a very effective way.
And what signal do you want that to send to Moscow?
We are sending signal to Moscow that they will not be able to achieve anything in Ukraine.
That's quite a big statement. They're not going to achieve anything in Ukraine. Arguably, they already have.
Of course, they have something. But, you know, if they are still dreaming about occupation of the whole Ukraine, that will not come. This is formula peace through strength, which is very much supported, you know, both by Europeans and Americans. We are very practically starting to implement this formula. Ukrainian side needs additional strength, and we're bringing the strength.
EU Defence Commissioner Andrius Kubilius. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. We're going to head to Canada now, because later today the country's governing Liberal Party will announce who will replace Justin Trudeau as its leader and therefore Prime Minister. There are four candidates in the running. Whoever wins will have to deal with an increasingly strained relationship with the US and discontent over the high cost of living. Rebecca Hartman reports.
Mark Carney launches.
The former governor of the Bank of Canada.
Mark Carney is now officially entering the race.
Of the four candidates vying to become the next Prime Minister of Canada, Mark Carney is the frontrunner.
But one core principle has guided my life's work ever since. Markets don't have values. People do.
The man who was governor of the Bank of Canada in the wake of the 2008 financial crash, and then the Bank of England as the UK left the European Union, has the endorsement of many members of Trudeau's cabinet.
Whether it's affordability, housing, fighting climate change, or
the other candidates are the Liberal House leader, Carina Gould, who has served in numerous positions in Mr. Trudeau's government.
And what I believe in to get our economy going is what I call investing in ourselves.
And Frank Bayliss, a former Liberal Member of Parliament, whose campaign has focused on his experience in business.
Donald Trump's nickname for me is the killer.
And the former Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland. Her resignation as Finance Minister and Deputy Prime Minister in December was a huge political blow to Mr. Trudeau and added to the growing pressure for him to resign.
This country deserves a real choice in the next election, and it has become clear to me that if I'm having to fight internal battles, I cannot be the best option in that election.
It's been 2 months since Prime Minister Trudeau announced he was standing down. After 9 years in power under his leadership, the popularity of the Liberal Party had plummeted to an all-time low. His government's handling of immigration policies and high inflation proved unpopular in the polls.
I spoke to Governor Trudeau on numerous occasions, and we'll see what happens. But
it is the relationship with Canada's southern neighbour that has become a key issue of this campaign.
So I think Canada is going to be a very serious contender to be our 51st state.
How to handle that relationship with President Trump and the US dominated the leadership television debates in February.
But let me start by being clear. We will never, ever be part of the United States in any way, shape or form.
This is Mark Carney at one of those debates.
We have to recognize that the Donald Trump of today is different than the Donald Trump of several years ago. Then his objective was to take more of our market. Now he wants to take our country.
President Trump's tariff threats became a reality on Tuesday, though later in the week, many were temporarily suspended until April. Chrystia Freeland led Canada's economic response to Trump during his first administration. This was her pitch to voters during that same debate in February.
My first move is dollar for dollar retaliation. And let me be very clear with President Trump. If I am prime minister, I will not flinch. We will retaliate. If you hit us, we will hit back. But our retaliation will be a lot smarter than their dumb tariffs.
The successful candidate will become Prime Minister of Canada, but for how long is uncertain. They will lead the Liberal Party into a federal election that must be held before the 20th of October. Whilst the Liberal Party have received a boost in opinion polls in recent weeks, they will have to prove to the public they are the breath of fresh air many Canadians crave.
Rebecca Hartman reporting. Well, let's hear live now from Ottawa and Martina Stevens-Grineff, Canada Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Martina, very good to have you with us here on NewsHour. What's your sense about the likely winner? Is Mark Carney edging ahead?
I think every poll shows that. It's clear that he has an edge. That being said, I do want to flag to listeners that the party is using a ranked ballot, which means that if Mr. Carney doesn't win the first round outright, you know, ranked ballot systems sometimes produce surprises. So there's still an outside chance. And I think it's important to note that Chrystia Freeland is the runner-up.
He is not a member of parliament, though. Does that mean that if he were to win, there would have to be an election rather sooner than later?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that his campaign has already indicated that. And so I believe that that's what we should expect. If he does win this vote tonight, he'll likely be sworn in prime minister early next week, perhaps Monday or Tuesday. And then our expectation is that, yes, he would call a federal election as soon as possible, which, by the way, seems to also be what most Canadians want.
Right. But so it's not an obstacle to becoming prime minister if you haven't got a seat in parliament.
Not technically.
Yeah. The Liberal Party under Justin Trudeau had been flailing pretty badly in the polls a few months ago. What impact has Donald Trump had on the party's popularity?
Oh, the Liberals have had a tremendous Trump bump. It's really actually stunning to see the turnaround. As you said, they were trailing the Conservatives so badly. At some point, it was 27 percentage points. Imagine that. And the removal of Justin Trudeau from the equation and Mr. Trump's persistent menacing threats to Canadian sovereignty through tariffs, but also other threats that he's leveled, including on their border. Those seem to have galvanized people around the Liberals. So while we're in a situation of flux, of course, and a new leader would give, would give Canadian voters some time to think whether, you know, they truly want the Liberals back in office. They have been craving change. It's so far been working very well for the Liberals and very badly for the Conservatives, who are just seen as too similar, perhaps, to Mr. Trump, whether that's fair or not.
Yeah. And on Donald Trump's rhetoric, I mean, we heard it in the piece then about Canada becoming America's 51st state. I mean, how's that been regarded now, a few weeks in? I mean, is it still regarded as bluster, a negotiating tactic, or are people, especially in government, taking it very seriously indeed?
Well, I think Canadians, did not think it was a joke from the start. And I think the rest of the world is catching up. My reporting shows, we had a story about this on Thursday, an exclusive, shows that the Canadian government takes it deadly seriously because Donald Trump specifically told Justin Trudeau on a phone call in early February that he wanted to revise the border treaty between the two countries, as well as water sharing agreements. And then top officials from the Trump administration told top Canadian officials going further that the president was interested in, for example, removing Canada from the Five Eyes intelligence sharing agreement that Britain is part of, revisiting their military cooperation, which is really key to especially the aerospace in North America. So this is really, really serious stuff. And I think Canadians are just feeling a very, very small relief to see that the world is catching up to what they've known from the start, that this is menacing. It's not a joke.
Martina, thank you very much indeed. Good to talk to you. Martina Stavis-Gridneff, Canada Bureau Chief for the New York Times, joining us live there from Ottawa. Now, Russia's recruiting criminal gangs in the UK for widespread acts of espionage. That's according to an investigative journalist targeted by Bulgarian nationals working for Moscow. Three of the Bulgarians were convicted in a London court on Friday of spying in one of the largest foreign intelligence operations on UK soil. Well, one man in the gang's crosshairs was the investigative journalist Christo Grozev. He exposed the Russians behind the Salisbury poisonings in 2018. He now works at The Insider and Der Spiegel. Well, he's been telling my colleague Paddy O'Connell that he's lucky to be alive. And he began by explaining how the Kremlin is increasingly using outsourced espionage.
This is a trend that we have seen develop after some failures of Russian intelligence operations across Europe. One of the failures was actually the disclosure of the Russian spies that attempted to assassinate Sergei Skripal and almost killed his daughter and did kill a British citizen, Don Sturges, in 2018. That was not supposed to happen, and they were not supposed to be disclosed either. But subsequently, several other operations were blundered, and then spies were disclosed, partly thanks to reporting of open-source investigators like Bellingcat, the organization that I worked with at the time. And this led to the necessity for Russia to use less discernible operatives. And they moved in the direction of freelancers and non-professional spies and outsourced violence as one of the ways that they could disguise and obfuscate their involvement in certain operations.
Mm. And of course, there's a link here to the case at the Old Bailey recently, because the men in question said they'd been visiting Salisbury Cathedral as tourists and they were mocked, and there was humour about that. And similarly, one of the papers said in your case, the Bulgarian operatives were bungling in the UK. But actually, there's serious intent to kill, kidnap and undermine.
There is, and it's very difficult to not see the humor in it and to realize that all of this is extremely somber. The fact that they're using, in many cases, non-professional bumbling idiots, as we may call them, doesn't take away from the intent to kill. And some of the problems with outsourced violence that we see recently is that these non-spies, they do not know how to de-escalate from certain situations where professional spies would know not to continue with an operation when innocent people, bystanders, family members' lives are at risk. In one particular case that actually involves my own family safety, the spies that were working for the Russian intelligence services entered my apartment in Vienna in 2022 when my son was playing a computer game in his room. And I just don't want to think about what would have happened if my son had decided to go out of his room during their burglary.
And also, can we list some of the ways they plotted to kill you?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the list of imagined assassination methods, this reads like a film noir. One of the ways that they fantasized about killing me was hiring an ISIS suicide bomber and having him explode himself next to me in the street. Another way was bludgeoning me to death using a sledgehammer. There was also the plan to kidnap me and send me to a torture camp in Syria, while another man with a latex mask with my face would fly ostensibly to Russia on a commercial flight in order to be arrested in front of cameras for full deniability. The fantasy and imagination of these wannabe spies is beyond any imagination.
Did you ever actively suddenly realise you were being filmed? Did you realise you were being followed long before you proved it?
I did have a couple of incidents across Europe that showed that somebody was tracking me. During the time that we now know the group broke into my apartment in Vienna, I remember that my then 14-year-old daughter told me, "Dad, I think there's a spy following us in the street." And in fact, it turns out that there was a spy, a member of the group who has now been convicted, was watching us to make sure we don't go back into the apartment.
Scotland Yard has hinted that Moscow is recruiting criminal gangs here. Knowing what you know, how active since the Cold War is this outsourced espionage by the Kremlin in the United Kingdom?
My understanding is that more and more there's outsourcing to criminal gangs, fringe groups in society, far-right neo-Nazi groups, football hooligans, and these are much harder to identify for domestic security services because it literally means you're looking at needles in a haystack. It's really harder than spotting real Russian spies, and it's going to be the new challenge.
And that was the investigative journalist Christo Grozev talking there to my colleague Paddy O'Connell. You're listening to News Hour. We used to have wake-up calls, but in recent days we received an electroshock. The words of a former German ambassador to Washington last week, talking about the impact of the Trump administration on America's relationship with Europe, and in particular the dramatic shift in Washington's approach to the war in Ukraine. In an effort to end the conflict and get Europe to do more of the heavy lifting, President Trump has suspended military aid and intelligence sharing with Ukraine. He's also called President Zelensky a dictator. And of course, there was that very public dressing down at the White House. And yet, there's little evidence of similar pressure being put on Russia to make compromises. In fact, Washington's already suggested President Putin will get to keep much of the territory it's taken, and that NATO membership for Ukraine is a non-starter. And so, in the minds of many in Europe, and Canada too, it looks as if the transatlantic alliance is on life support. Well, let's discuss some of this with George Beebe, Director of Grand Strategy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft in Washington, D.C., also a former Director of Russia Analysis at the CIA, and Evelyn Farkas, Executive Director of the McCain Institute, named after the U.S. Senator John McCain, and a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia and Ukraine under President Obama. Welcome to you both. I'm going to begin with George Beebe, if I may, first of all. Many people think the Trump administration is siding with Russia against Ukraine. Is that what's happening? And if so, why?
Well, no, I don't think the Trump administration is siding with Russia. I think what Trump is trying to do is to end this war in a compromise settlement. And I think he recognizes that this war is not going to end in Russian capitulation or unconditional surrender. There's going to have to be a compromise. And what the Russians are looking for is a geopolitical compromise. They want the United States to recognize that NATO's enlargement into Ukraine or some sort of American military presence in Ukraine is a security threat to Russia. They want a concession in that regard. And I think what Trump is doing is signaling to the Russians that we recognize that has to be part of the deal. But the Russians going to have to make concessions. And I think they're going to have to concede that Ukraine will be a sovereign, independent country, that it will be reconstructed, and that it has a viable path toward membership in the European Union. So that's the process that I think we have underway. And the Ukrainians have to understand that that's the direction that they need to go to. And right now, Zelensky is not saying he's willing to do that. He wants this war to continue. He wants the United States to extend an Article 5 style NATO security guarantee to Ukraine. We're not going to do that. So that's why we're seeing the pressures that we're seeing on Ukraine right now.
Okay. Evelyn Farkas, is that how you see the dynamic at the moment?
No, not at all. I would disagree that the Ukrainian government doesn't want peace. The Ukrainian government does want peace. The Ukrainian government does want an end to the war. And I don't think that Vladimir Putin's objection is to NATO enlargement because, of course, Sweden and Finland just joined NATO and he barely mentions it. The issue is that this Russian president and his his people around him in the Kremlin, they have a neo-imperial agenda. They want to absorb Ukraine into the Russian Federation, eliminate the Ukraine's sovereignty. So I don't think that, unfortunately, I don't think that the Russian government has an objective that allows Ukraine to maintain its sovereignty. And in fact, what's happening right now is it looks like we are driving or trying to drive Ukraine to an unconditional surrender because our president has taken away leverage that Ukraine might have had in order to achieve the compromise that George describes. The other part of it is, of course, that the reason the Ukrainian government will not accept a compromise that ends where George described it without a security guarantee is because there's a lack of trust in the Kremlin and in President Putin, because he has signed agreements before for ceasefires, for the cessation of hostilities, and then he reinvaded. So the Ukrainians don't trust the Russians.
Yeah, let me put
and
that,
we shouldn't either.
let me put that precise point to George Beebe. Is the Trump administration being naive towards Vladimir Putin, that in fact he only understands hard power and may not keep his word?
Well, no, I don't think they're being naive at all. I think they recognize that the Russians are not simply going to end this war out of the goodness of their heart, out of goodwill, or because it's quote unquote the right thing to do. There's going to have to be a combination of diplomacy and force. In other words, there will need to be a deterrent force, and that's going to take two forms, I think. One is going to be Ukraine's own self-defense capabilities, and the other is going to be NATO and the strength of NATO's own military capabilities vis-a-vis Russia, which have to be built up. I think that's clearly an element of this that the Trump administration is focusing on. But the other part of this is we have done deals, quote unquote, arms control deals, confidence and security building measures, other kinds of diplomatic understandings throughout the Cold War period with the Soviet Union. We didn't trust the Soviet Union to adhere to those deals because the Soviet Union was trustworthy or good in any way. We trusted but verified, as Ronald Reagan put it. We put in place the means to verify compliance. That worked pretty well during the Cold War period. I don't think anyone would go back and say, you know, we actually should have fought to liberate the Baltic states from Soviet domination. So we understood how to do this then. I think we understand now how to do it.
I just want to ask you both one final question in the sort of minute and a half we've got left. And Evelyn Farkas, first of all, how much damage has been done to the transatlantic relationship over all this?
It's on the brink of rupture. It's really in terrible distress. And I would say I was in the Pentagon when Vladimir Putin dismantled all of those conventional and nuclear arms agreements. So unfortunately, again, it's Vladimir Putin that's the problem here. If there were another Russian government, maybe there'd be a shot. But the damage that is being done right now, it's not completely broken, but there's, again, we're on the brink of something very new here.
George Beebe, does that matter if America's allies can't trust it anymore? Does it simply matter that America's national interest is looked after?
Well, I think the Trump administration actually wants a strong and healthy Europe and a strong and healthy transatlantic alliance. What it doesn't want is a situation where Europe continues to outsource its security to the United States, where Europe is essentially a subordinate vassal to the United States without its own capabilities of deterring Russia. We're heading into a multipolar order. And I think the Trump administration recognizes that in that order, Europe has to be one of the poles.
Okay.
So I think that's the adjustment that has to happen.
Thank you both very much. We'll have to leave it there. George Beebe and Evelyn Farkas. Many thanks to you both. And that brings us to the end of this edition of the program. From me and the rest of the NewsHour team, thanks so much for listening. Until the next time, bye-bye.